Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, November 5th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
Zohran Mamdani, a 34-year-old state lawmaker, was elected New York's 111th mayor on Tuesday, riding a historic surge of enthusiasm as the nation's largest city embraced generational and ideological change. The Associated Press called the race just 35 minutes after polls closed, cementing a stunning upset that took root in June's Democratic primary. Then and now, Mr. Mamdani handily dispatched former Governor Andrew Cuomo, the scion of a New York dynasty and the big money super PACs that were backing him. Tuesday's results underscored how thoroughly Mr. Mamdani has built his own new coalition of support, uniting younger voters with working-class immigrant enclaves in Queens, but he also made gains in working-class Black and Latino communities compared with the primary. So just look at what happened in June compared to what happened yesterday. In an era of low turnout nationwide, participation in Tuesday's election in New York City was nothing short of electric, approaching numbers not seen in half a century. More than 2 million New Yorkers cast their ballots. No matter how you look at it, no matter who you voted for, that is an impressive feat and something that I believe is good for democracy. In some areas of Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan, participation approached presidential election levels for a mayoral race. Mr. Mamdani, a Democratic socialist who promised New Yorkers free childcare, free buses, and a rent freeze on rent-stabilized apartments, drove the surge. He was the first candidate since John Lindsay in 1969 to win over 1 million votes in a mayoral election in the five boroughs. Overall turnout that year of 2.4 million people still slightly topped Tuesday's total, however. Mamdani built his own Democratic coalition. For decades, Democrats in New York City have prevailed with a fairly static coalition, white liberals in Manhattan and Brooklyn, Black and Latino voters, ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, and a smattering of other immigrants. Early results suggest that Mr. Mamdani rework the contours of that coalition, stitching together new alliances that could shift the city's political outlook for years to come. This from the coverage in the New York Times. Using the Associated Press numbers with 91% of the vote in, Zohran Mamdani did hit over 50%, 50.4%. Andrew Cuomo, 41.6%, and Curtis Sliwa, the Republican candidate, 7.1%. Terry Gibson, what do you make of this?
Well, the fine people of New York City have spoken loud and clear. They are ready for something new, and the majority of those voters that spoke are in the category that we might classify as young, and I'm just so happy to see them getting involved in this so important race, but more importantly, just getting involved in politics. I think that what we see is the beginning of the end of the Democratic Party as we have known it for so long. I think this will energize more young people across the country to get involved in public service, whether it's running for mayor, city council, or Congress, or state senate, or whatever it might be. And at least from my perspective, I think it's past time for the Democratic Party to open its doors to this new generation of leaders and let them bring in their new ideas and their new energy. And I think it's the only way to really reform the party and to achieve the goals that so many of us have been fighting for so long that just seem to be unattainable at the moment. I think you'll see the older leaders like Chuck Schumer and that lot will be slowly pushed out by more popular figures. It'll be inspired by this win. So And for New York City, you know, it's going to be a new dawn. And this young man has his work cut out for him. I mean, there's not a place on the planet really that probably has more problems that need to be addressed. And so we're going to see what he's made of very quickly. It's probably the greatest test that any politician could ever endure. Many have failed the test. And I certainly hope that for his sake and for America's sake and for New York City's sake that he passes that test.
Bob Griffin.
Well, a couple of, at first, Joe, I think, and I know you wanted to start with the city, but I think we'd be remiss if we weren't even a little closer and just recognize that Albany elected the first black mayor in its history last night as well.
Dorsey Appleers, a former panelist on this program, and only former because she left to run for mayor. But we as we have our current mayor on occasionally, I hope Dorsey will come back. She has said she would, and we're very happy to see one of our panelists go off and become the mayor of the city, and another first for this city.
I'm not going to steal any thunder, so I won't go too far into it. I would be very careful about extrapolating last night as a huge change. I will admit that I feel much better than I did a year ago today.
I think Teresa's more like a surging electrical storm, but that's okay. Go ahead.
But understanding, I'm feeling better than I did a year ago today. But it's like after I've had several of my organs removed. So it's been quite a year. There are some interesting commonalities, and I know we're going to talk about some of the other races, Joe. But the issue of affordability. And the overall concern and continued angst across the country about where the economy is, I think is something that we absolutely need to talk about. I also think we need to talk about the fact that the messaging in New York was laser sharp. It was spot on, and they weren't able to tease him off of his message about affordability, about what really mattered to the voters. So yeah, his youth, I thought he was very articulate. But if you think about it, he took on not only the Republican Party, but he took on the Democratic establishment in the city. And so I think it was described in a couple of articles as almost fighting a two-front war. I also think that there's a level of frustration that I think you could tease out from the New York City vote, but also New Jersey and Virginia, about people are generally very dissatisfied with the direction of the country, and are looking for something different, even when that difference may be to go to somebody who has, you know, is less experienced or is espousing some positions that make some of us uncomfortable. If I could sum it up this way, is that the feeling from some of the folks that I've talked to, particularly some of the younger folks on campus, is you can't screw things up any worse than the establishment has. Let's give it a shot because things aren't working right now. So there is this sort of like, okay, things aren't right here, but there's also a willingness and hope. And that's the other element that I appreciated about last night, is that there was elements of how do we uplift everybody, not just the people who are in my party, which was what we've pretty much seen since January.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Bob, this notion of being on people's side and understanding their challenge, and on everybody's side, not just the people who are in your party or who, you know, not just the 30%. I think that I'd like to talk about New York City in the context of votes across the country as well. And Terry, I agree with you on the young people, but I do fundamentally disagree with you on the denigration of Senator Schumer and the other Democrats. I think that the vote yesterday was an overwhelming, enthusiastic, hopeful vote against the Trump administration and the Republicans in the House and Senate who are supporting him, or in their silence are complicit with him. And I think that it was amazing the number of young people who came out in New York City and around the country enthusiastically. My brother lives in New Jersey. I checked in with my niece, who is just turned 24 and has not been very much politically active in the past. But I talked to her last night. She was so excited about the governor's win there. She was, for the first time ever, got involved, did some phone banking, the kind of thing she'd never done before. She was telling me that friends of hers from around the country, she graduated from Rutgers, friends of hers from around the country who knew she lived in New Jersey were checking in to make sure that she voted because they knew how important the New Jersey race was. She was reaching out. She said her friends from New York City, the same thing. There was a lot of talk about this in ways that she said she'd never been involved in a campaign like this before. And their concern was both against Trump and for the kinds of things, the, you know, healthcare issues, mental health issues are something that's her area of work. She was attracted to Mickey Sherrill. But this engagement of young people, a friend of mine was noting when she was watching the California return. She said the pundits weren't talking about it, but look at all the young people in line for these off-year elections. So I think that this level of enthusiasm. And the issues are, you know, connectivity, that the Democrats are on your side. That drove turnout, you know, understanding these core issues of affordability, of health security, of economic security. And then I also think we need to look at the overwhelming vote of women and Latinos. Latinos shifted back to the Democratic Party yesterday in record numbers. And I watched Fox News for several hours last night. I just wanted to see how they would recovering it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was interesting that first of all they barely covered they didn't carry the Spamberger or Mickey Sherrill's speeches. They were just Mondani and denigrating him. But they were speculating why they lost Latinos, and one of them said possibly because of some of the practices of ICE. Like, possibly, you know. In any case, but I think that this was a resounding support for the Democrats for their message, and I think we have to thank Chuck Schumer for what he did, what they're doing on health care, having a force and function to get us to focus on the Republicans trying to decimate health care.
Mike, we're making better. Oh, go ahead, Terry.
I was just going to say, I think the issue of how Democrats are dealing with the shutdown in terms of healthcare focus and Chuck Schumer's work on that, I think, to me, that's kind of a separate issue. I think what's interesting about Mamdani's win is that he put together this coalition and achieved this amazing victory without the very public and vocal support that people running for this office typically get from leaders like Chuck Schumer, from leaders of the Democratic Party. Some of them did come out and endorse him late. Many of them shied away from him. I understand why they did that because of some of the stances he has on various issues. But the reason I think it's a new dawn for the Democratic Party is because he has figured out a way to achieve the success without relying on the traditional standard bearers of the party like Chuck Schumer. You know, I think Chuck Schumer for his service, I think he's done an incredible job, but I use him just as sort of a stereotype to represent those that I think have just been there too long and have really reached sort of their maximum ability to do what they can do. And it's just time for a new breed, for a new generation to come forward. And I spend my time around, as some of you do as well, around a lot of young people, like all day long in the classroom.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that regardless of where they live in the country, and I have students from all over the place, in the world including, they are really energized by this person's candidacy, really energized by it. And they recognize the language he's using. They recognize the symbolic imagery that he uses. They just relate to it in ways that they just do not relate to the language that those like Chuck Schumer use. They're just, he's just more in touch with that base.
All right, so here's my problem.
You need a break.
No, I'm good.
I just got to disagree with you.
Okay. All right. So let me pile on with Terry because I'm mostly in agreement, and then you can pile on to both of us. Terry just said something about, I understand why they didn't endorse. I don't understand it. I really don't understand it. You had a primary within the city of New York, and this man was elected by the Democrats of New York City to be their candidate by an overwhelming margin, and continue to be a force in the election. Now, I'm not saying it has to be a full-throated support, but I don't understand. Okay, so if you don't want to make an endorsement, you don't have to make an endorsement. But don't today, and I already have 70 of these, of, wow, this is the fundraising from the Democratic Party, talking about how we're all one big party, and look at what happened in New York City, and look at what happened in New Jersey, and look what happened in Virginia. Well, where the hell were you a week ago on this of kumbaya and bringing everybody together? So that annoys me. I think I don't understand why, if you were going to talk about democracy, if you were going to talk about younger people getting involved in politics, if you were going to talk about a party and a revitalizing a party, I can't think of a better way to revitalize a party than to have younger people and older people and less experienced people and more experienced people actually come together to work on it.
Because what they did is run on the core Democratic issues, whether it was in Miami, where a woman is poised to be the next mayor. There's got to be a runoff. But she did quite well in Detroit. First woman mayor elected in Detroit's history. Amazing background. Grandfather was a leader in the civil rights and labor movement. And now, his granddaughter is elected as mayor of Detroit. Whether it's in Georgia, where the Public Service Commission folks, Democrats, won for the first time because of utility rates, mm-hmm. Where people came out in record numbers, all over the country, and they're running on these core issues. The core issues are affordability, healthcare, kitchen table economics, and they are it's against what the Trump administration has done, but it's for these core things that Democrats are for, have been for a long time.
So why can't you endorse on that alone?
What do you mean, why can't you? Why didn't Schumer endorse? I think I do know why, presume why Schumer didn't endorse, but it didn't matter. He won. Right?
No,
why does it matter? Why does it matter?
No, that's kind of the point. The kind of point is that it didn't matter. The point is that it didn't matter if Schumer endorsed him because
because he was running on the issues.
He's obsolute.
No,
his
running.
Power is becoming obsolete in the party itself, not in Washington, but in the party itself.
But what better reason?
I cannot believe that the Democrats had a major win across the country at all levels of government, and you're denigrating the Democrats. I don't get this.
Terry. Status quo. I'm applauding them for going around the status quo and picking someone that they think represents what they want to achieve and not relying on the status quo to approve it or not approve it. I'm just saying that it's the first time in a long time we've had someone like this get elected without relying on the leaders of the party to help them do it. And that's
but the
incredible.
Party.
So let me jump in here and disagree with y'all, okay?
about time.
I don't think this
hold on. Yeah. Let me talk.
Sorry.
Okay. The Democrats need to do an open primary. Okay. I think one of the things that killed them with the Harris nomination last time is that the feeling that it was put on tracks and the people were being told there needs to be an open primary system. And where Mamdani really succeeded is that he won through a process that should have garnered him support. Okay, so you either support what the voters are telling you or you don't, but you can't have it both ways. Okay,
right.
you can't jump on after he's winning. The issue of certainly affordability. I'll keep going back to that. Affordability, affordability, affordability. But here's the thing. Okay, don't let Fox tell us who is the face of the Democratic Party, and that's exactly what they're trying to do. Okay. It's what last night shows you, though, is that this is a party that has an enormous spread. If you take advantage of it and let people be themselves, run a primary system, see who can float, who comes to the top, and put that person up against whoever the maggots are putting up. But let's not play this thing where we allow Fox to determine who the face of this party is.
Exactly right. And that's what AOC said about this election, that it's when she was asked, is he now the face of the Democratic Party? And she said, we're a big party. We're a big party. We have a range of people.
The face of the Democratic Party should be every working man and woman in this country. That's what the face of the party should be. It shouldn't be a person.
That was Robert Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 5th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, November 6th, Joe was joined by Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Dittis, Ulster County Comptroller and former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Airports, shut down, flights, FAA, air traffic controllers, I know one does not perhaps have anything to do with the other, but as we're having this discussion, we can't just constantly see this video of a plane exploding as it's going into Louisville. So the Trump administration says the move, which is ordering the FAA to cut 10% in flights at several airports, will affect some 40 markets, part of an effort to ease pressure on air traffic controllers. Some of the nation's busiest airports, including those serving Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, and D.C., could be among the ones that will offer fewer flights beginning Friday, otherwise known as tomorrow, according to a person briefed on the process who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal plans. However, the person cautioned the list is preliminary and could change as discussions continue. The flight reductions were announced Thursday as part of a Trump administration effort aimed at easing pressure on air traffic controllers and other frontline aviation personnel working without pay as the government shutdown, the longest in history, enters its second month. The current list of airports, most of the ones you would expect, Albany isn't on it, but Anchorage is ones that I think probably would directly affect us, Boston, Baltimore, Charlotte, Dallas, Reagan, Denver, Dallas-Fort Worth, Fort Lauderdale,
JFK is on there. LaGuardia is on there.
JFK and LaGuardia, correct.
But not Newark, strangely.
Orlando, Chicago, Chicago O'Hare and Chicago Midway, as well as Philadelphia International Airport. So I won't read all 40, but you get the idea that these are, it's a
hubs.
Have fun.
Yeah.
especially coming from, if you fly out of Albany, and I there's nothing more I love out of Albany, but there are not many direct flights. They are unless you're going to Baltimore. But as far as usually, if you're going from one place to the other, there is a stop, and so that brings you into another airport system. So I'm not aware in my 35-year history in aviation where we've had a situation where we're taking these kinds of measures, according to FAA head Brian Bedford at a news conference on Wednesday. Then again, we're in new territory in terms of government shutdowns. A 10% cut at a major hub like Chicago O'Hare, for example, could mean 121 fewer flights or more than 14,500 fewer seats a day, according to an estimate by an aviation analytics data firm, Cirium. There will be frustration, said Sean Duffy.
Understatement of 2025.
But in the end, our sole role is to make sure that we keep the airspace as safe as possible. I'm good with that. I'm good with keeping the air safe, the airspace safe.
Well, they say it's data-driven, and Democrats are starting to ask, okay, then share the data. What is the risk assessment behind this? You know, I think that this is just one big happy Thanksgiving. Either your family is too broke to really afford Thanksgiving and isn't going to get SNAP, or if you're middle class and you're flying anyone anywhere in the country, we're going to make that a nightmare too. So I think that it's really just a vengeful tactic. I was stunned to see that there are such there's such a vacancy rate in the ranks of air traffic controllers, 3,000 vacancies among 14,000 positions. That's a 21.4% vacancy rate. I mean, like, I think about my operation and what we would do if we didn't have that. You know, these air traffic controllers are all working overtime to make up the difference, and now you have them going two paychecks without. I was reading some of them are working second jobs like Uber to make up the difference. And, you know, this is just ridiculous. This is not a way to govern. This is a critical infrastructure, super important responsibility of the federal government. And Trump is using revenge, I feel like, to target here when he could be paying them with tariffs. We were talking about, where is the tariff money going? Well, we did fund WIC with tariff money because he knew that was going to look bad. Well, fund air traffic controllers. You know, let's get something done here. So I think it's a big, happy, unhappy Thanksgiving present from Trump.
Do you think we picked a bad year to go to Hawaii for Christmas?
No. Every year is a good year to go to Hawaii, Joe.
Okay.
When I first heard this, I really wanted the data. I wanted to know, what exactly are they trying to do? And it seems like they're just trying to turn the screws just a little bit, and they have no compassion for anyone who's ever flown commercial, because it is tough. I mean, has Donald Trump ever flown commercial? This is just, and it's like a war on Thanksgiving, a war on Christmas. We're going to get, you know, tariffs on our imported Christmas trees from Canada. Look at the calendar. It's 3 weeks away. It's the busiest travel day of the year. People have vacations planned that are non-refundable. I already heard of something. There were cancellations in Orlando last week or the week before, and I heard of a family that got in their car from upstate New York and drove, what, the 12 to 18 hours to Disney, because those were non-refundable, and they had planned this for years.
That's what we're going to do to Hawaii. it's true, and it seems to be very Doge-like in the sense of it's about the numbers and maybe less about the common sense of figuring out what goes where and how.
Yeah, I mean, if the political intent is to bring the argument back that this is the Democrats' fault, pardon the pun, I don't think this is going to land well, because they're the ones that are doing it and they're the ones that are in charge. The last government shutdown that ended, the 2018 into 2019, ended because of air traffic controllers not going to work. It wasn't a large group of people, but that's what got everybody back to the table. So Sean Duffy, I can't look at him with, I'm a child of the 90s, I can't look at him without remembering that he was on reality TV back in the day, so it's hard for me to take him seriously. But I think this is a miscalculation. This is going to just make people even that much more upset at the Trump administration for making their lives harder.
I mean, I actually, I don't think it's a political ploy. I think they're doing it because they actually think they have to, because they know the shutdown is projected to last until January. And even in the case of WIC, that was a short term. It's likely not even a legal use of those tariffs. There is not an appropriation bill that funds WIC right now. All of the appropriations expire, run out by the end of the year. So my program, my legal services corporations, all of the, you know, the HUD, housing vouchers and Section 8, HEAP benefits, all of those are actually ending. They're truly actually ending. And I think in this case, the air traffic controllers are a resource that are coming to the end of its line, and they are worried about the safety of people during holiday travel. There have been airplanes that ran into each other. There are airports that close on no notice because nobody showed up to work that day. Newark was closed last week, right?
Yeah.
And at random, I mean, there's no even way to know that the controllers aren't coming to work because they all got picked up their Uber shifts. Like, I think this move actually scares the GOP. I think they are acting in a conservative way, not like little C conservative, in a preservation way, because they are going to get blamed for crashes that happen on the tarmac because there aren't controllers out there.
No, I think
which we're already seeing.
I agree with you. Also, when you hear the unions, in regards to aviation, from the pilots and the workers on the planes and so forth, of them expressing their great concerns and saying this is not sustainable, we can't keep doing this, or things are already really dangerous, and if we keep doing it, it's going to be even more so.
Right. And all of those airline companies, these, you know, billion-dollar industries, are going to experience the economic impact of fatal crashes, of flights not being able to leave or arrive or handle their lines safely, or having to be redirected to other airports. I think this is actually probably a smart move, given the fact that the shutdown is nowhere near ending.
I think that this may be the straw that breaks the camel's back on the shutdown. And it's sad, from my perspective, that elimination of food stamps didn't do it.
Yeah, you would think starving children would do it, but no.
If I can't go to Disney,
I can't get to Orlando.
Duffy also said that mass chaos will occur if the shutdown goes on, and he said, we, quote, may close parts of national airspace. I thought that was very profound and scary. What does that actually mean? You know, what would that look like? And also, I saw that 80% of air traffic controllers were absent last Friday from New York's busiest hub. What? Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear 80% of air traffic controllers are absent.
And how incredible that the United States of America can't keep its airports open. Like, that should send shockwaves through everybody.
Well, and I was reading an article two nights ago, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't quote it or quote it even probably accurately, but I'm going to give it a shot, which was another point that this article was making, is that we've seen increased times at airports where there have been computer malfunctions and things taken off the grid and flights had to be halted. And while that may or may not have to do with the lack of people, what does have to do with the lack of people is, now how do you get it back on? And as the prevalence of that continues, of these entire airlines just sort of going off the map as far as being able to control where they are, where they're going, what's happening in any one airport, and causing all kinds of confusion and delays, that the people who are there to fix that would no longer be there to fix that. And I think that's a big point as well.
Yeah, and it should be highlighting our crumbling and outdated and already past expiration transportation infrastructure. And somebody's got to be talking about the fact that this administration canceled all of the infrastructure projects that had been launched in the previous administration. I mean, it's not like if Newark Airport is shut down, I can hop on my high-speed train and get to D.C. from Albany, because I cannot. And that, you know, would have been the alternative if we had passed an infrastructure reform bill 20 years ago when it was already past due.
You know, could we get an update from Sean Duffy about his effort to rebuild the air traffic control system and recruit new people so they can boost the staff there? I mean, we heard a lot about it after the Washington, D.C. crash, I think, but I haven't heard anything since. How about a status report?
Good luck recruiting federal employees now. Hey, we're not going to pay you for weeks at a time. We're going to treat you like, you know, crud, and it's going to be very stressful. Yeah, I think they're going to have a huge problem going forward. I saw United Airlines said it's not going to really affect their international flights. They're going to focus the pain on regional and domestic. Mm-hmm. So that's all of us and our families.
That was March Gallagher on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, November 6th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, November 7th, Joe was joined by senior fellow and faculty member in the Center for the Advancement of Public Action at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, and co-author of the book The Problem with Plastic, Judith Enck, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Siena University professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti.
This is a national story. There's no question about it for a lot of reasons, but Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from the 21st Congressional District in New York, she is my congresswoman. She is Aaron's congresswoman. Anybody else? No?
Not okay. Mine.
She is going to announce that she's running for governor, we believe, today. I think she has announced that it will be later today that she will make it official that she's running for governor. No real surprise here, except the fact that after she was going to take a job in the Trump administration, and she was poised and ready to go. And then they were worried about the numbers, or at least this is what they're saying. They were worried about the numbers in the House, so they put that on hold. And then the next thing you know, she's sort of out. She's out of leadership. She's out of all of those things that she had been in prior to that. And shortly thereafter is when she started to make some hints that she was going to run against Kathy Hochul in New York State, assuming that Kathy Hochul is the Democratic candidate. But I think suffice to say, regardless of that, right now she's running against Kathy Hochul. So we'll see what she has to say about this later on. She's a conservative upstate New York Republican, close ties to the White House, and will announce she will run for governor next year. The move, which is expected to be announced in a video, sets up a ferocious political battle between one of President Trump's fiercest allies and Kathy Hochul, a moderate Democrat. The contest is likely to be one of the key races in next year's crucial midterm elections. A spokesman for Ms. Stefanik would not comment about her plans. The people familiar with her intentions were not authorized to discuss them and cautioned the timing could still change. Ms. Stefanik is 41 years old. She began her career as a Harvard-educated moderate working in the White House of former President George W. Bush and for Paul Ryan, the 2012 Republican vice presidential nominee. But since Mr. Trump's first election, she has moved ever closer to the center of his orbit. She was a visible defender during his impeachments and amplified his lies about the 2020 election. Later, her viral showdowns with Ivy League university presidents about anti-Semitism on campuses helped push several to resign. This is the reporting from the New York Times. Those qualities have brought her enormous fundraising numbers and a national reputation among Republicans, but have also saddled her with baggage that could encumber her in a state that Democrats have governed for decades. Ms. Stefanik has made no secret about her eagerness to challenge Ms. Hochul, who has faced middling poll numbers for much of her tenure. Many of the Congresswoman's recent moves could be seen as a preview of her campaign strategy, conflating Ms. Hochul with Zohran Mamdani, now the mayor-elect of New York City, and running as their foil. That, again, from the New York Times. Oh, Judith Enck, what say you?
Well, do remember you mentioned this, that Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado is running against Governor Hochul in a primary. Stefanik is...
Has he officially announced?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know.
Yes. I mean, I know that was the intention. I just didn't know whether you officially announced. But okay, go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's great that Stefanik is running for three reasons. One is there will be a contrast between her and presumably Governor Hochul or Lieutenant Governor Delgado. A huge contrast. So voters will not be confused. The second reason why I think it's good is because she's going to lose. And then the third reason I think it's good is because we need to point out that you're in public service for the public good. And if you look at Elise Stefanik's career, it is really dominated by her starting out as a supposed moderate, and then she hitched her wagon to Trump. And that's not a good place to be today. Separate from that, you just have to have some principled bottom lines. And as far as I can tell, she has none. In her career in Congress, she does not stand up for the Affordable Care Act. She is not good on climate change. She doesn't stand up for education funding. She's a divider. I've never heard her speak out against racism. I think the way she beat up the college presidents during the hearings was pretty disturbing. And she was my Congress member for a short period of time. I really can't think of one thing that she's accomplished. I can't remember one town hall meeting that she's had. And apparently she's not good at math because there are 6.4 million Democrats enrolled in New York State, 3 million Republicans, and 3.4 million independents. Often the independents will decide this. And if I was her, I would have waited a little bit to analyze what happened this past Tuesday on Election Day. And others have done that. Bruce Blakeman, who just won re-election in Nassau County, is flirting with running, and there might be a primary. But my goodness, running during the midterms with the New Yorkers having really serious concerns about Trump, whether it's cutting SNAP funding or his reckless foreign affairs policies, I think if she's serious about winning, she's made a mistake, and I think it's great she's running.
And we're talking about Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from the 21st District in the state of New York, who is expected today to launch her campaign to challenge Governor Kathy Hochul, or we assume that will be the matchup. At very least, she is announcing that she will run for governor as a Republican candidate. So all of that coming up. We were talking to Judith Enck about this. So you let me go to back to you, and then we'll hear from our other panelists as well.
Let me just wrap up my rather unkind commentary on Elise Stefanik. So it's not just that she is a zebra mussel attached to Trump. It's also her policies. That's an invasive species found in the water. It's her policies are just awful. So on environmental issues, she has a 2024 voting score of zero. To be fair, her lifetime score is 26%. So you see the change. But in 2024, she voted the wrong way on lead poisoning prevention, on protecting drinking water. She voted to obstruct appliance efficiency standards so we don't save money on our utility bills. And she's very pro-fracking.
And let us just point out geographically also a representative within the Adirondack Park.
Right, right. You
would think so there is that.
Yeah, and people like to drink water without PFAS chemicals in it and not have lead in consumer products. But, you know, the thing about Kathy Hochul is I have some real serious concerns about her policies of late, particularly on climate change, that she's walking back the state's commitments on climate change. I really hope she does not approve the fracked gas pipelines, the Williams-Nessie pipelines and others, because the New York State DEC already rejected those pipelines and now she's resurrecting them. And this will be an early test for the new DEC commissioner and whether she follows the law or is susceptible to political pressure from the governor's office. So, you know, I have concerns with Governor Hochul's environmental record, but she is a serious elected official. She is in office to serve the public. She's speaking out against the SNAP cuts. I think she's having a hard time trying to figure out how to deal with Trump, and she's in a tough spot because we, as the state of New York, need to get federal tax dollars. I think it was smart that she endorsed Zoran Mamdani. I think she needs Zoran Mamdani more than Zoran Mamdani needs her to expand the electorate. But there's just comparing an opportunist politician like Stefanik to Hochul, who we may not agree with on everything, but I do think she is working in the public interest and she hasn't had ethics scandals and she's trying to improve the fate of the state. So it'll be an interesting race, but anything can happen. I would not rule out Bruce Blakeman because Republicans are strong on Long Island. And, you know, in fairness, you have to recognize that Antonio Delgado is also running, and a year is a long time in politics.
It certainly is. Aaron.
So I like how Judith phrased what I was thinking, and that is it's great she's running because she's most likely going to lose and get beat up. But I think this serves an additional purpose for Republicans, and that is it provides some visibility in a very big state, even though it's solidly blue, that you'll have some MAGA folks out there on the front lines that'll get Fox News interviews. And that's important in you know, the midterms where most likely Republicans are going to take a beating across the country. That was kind of made clear on Tuesday. So I see why they're doing it. I don't think it's going to be successful. I'm also a little bit puzzled when, you know, Republicans have a finite amount of resources to spend in putting people up for particularly, you know, larger positions like governor and, you know, allocating their resources to somebody in a state that's solidly blue doesn't seem like a good use of money. Like there might be purple states or there might be more competitive congressional races. So I'm a little bit baffled by that. But what we're going to hear is the normal populist, you know, Trump agenda about, you know, there's an affordability crisis, which there is in parts of New York. Taxes are too high. We need to lower regulations. It's going to be more of the same. But I think time is on Democrat side because the more string you give Trump for his policies to play out, the worse the economy is going to get. So trying to run as a, you know, MAGA Republican when the economy is becoming increasingly fragile to the point where the word recession is starting to get tossed around is going to very likely backfire. So that's my political analysis. But I also wanted to chime in with some sociological analysis about something Judith said. And I know people kind of laughed when I did this, but in 2016, when Trump won, I decided that I was going to watch all of The Apprentice season one to figure out what this dude's all about, because I had no idea what he was besides some shyster businessman. If you watch, you don't even need to watch the whole first season. I mean, bless your heart if you do. The first few episodes tell you everything you need to know about Trump. He is a bully. He enjoys being boss. He enjoys debasing and degrading people by making them do his bidding in embarrassing ways so he seems more powerful. And you see this with Stefanik. You see this with the unprincipled stand of being a modest pro-business Republican under Bush and then turning to the election was stolen. I don't know, you know, pick your random MAGA thing that she's gotten behind. But the thing that bothers me the most debasing thing that she has done to herself, is as a Harvard law grad, her tweets, was this last year or 2 years ago, all of a sudden started to appear in all caps. The grammar got worse. And for somebody like that to be so unprincipled that you're going to change the way you write and communicate, it's just embarrassing. And these are not people we want in office. That's a sign that she is in this for self-preservation. She's in this to serve her own needs. She's not in it, as Judith mentioned, to serve the public. And it's just a sign of the power Trump has over people to essentially become an entirely different person.
Heather Mulligan.
Woo! Well, first off, 1 year ago, roughly, give or take a few days, there was a huge and surprising upsurge in Republican turnout and people crossing the lines to vote for a Republican who had a history and a track record of doing the kinds of things that he's doing right now.
Lee Zeldin?
No. 1 year ago.
Okay.
1 year ago. It would be Donald J. Trump.
Oh, him.
Yeah. Yeah. That guy. Right?
Sure.
And so for my purposes, I think it is premature to predict what will happen 1 year from today. I think we've seen a huge rebuke and a stain on the Republican Party because of some of the policies that I think are extremely ill-advised and unpopular and ineffective. I don't know that that will be the case 1 year from now. I don't. I have no way of saying. We also don't know who the full field is. I mean, the hot rumor du jour is that de Blasio is now going to step in. And if you remember, he announced that he was running in 2022 and then changed his mind. But, you know, certainly there's a lot of people seeing an opportunity with respect to Governor Hochul, who I actually think has done a pretty good job on a number of issues in being a moderate, which represents the entirety of the state and not just where there is an extremely large concentration of power at the state level based out of the New York City metropolitan market. So, I mean, I do surveys. We're a statewide organization. I do surveys of our members on economic issues. They would say, you know, across the board that the economic condition of the state is not good right now. And whether or not that the view is that that is because of something nationally or at the state level is going to be a very large factor in the election next year. The popular, I mean, it's going to be a proxy between, I've seen both the ads, by the way, both are out. Elise Stefanik's announcement video, which is several minutes long, I think very long for a political ad. And you know, I don't think a lot of people sit and watch a YouTube video for 2+ minutes. It's already out. It's very, very clear that it's going to be about out-migration, affordability, the economy, and very, very clearly the incoming mayor of New York City. Vice versa, the governor very quickly had an ad up sort of rebuking Stefanik, and it's all about Trump. It's all about her standing in front of a Trump sign, her saying that she's his largest supporter, his most loyal first person to endorse him, all of those things. So right now the strategy is Trump versus Mamdani, which is interesting since Mamdani is not even in office yet, right? But it's Trump versus Mamdani plus economy affordability on both sides. I don't know how people are going to sort through that. I do know New York, you know, huge Democratic enrollment edge, as Judith very correctly pointed out, makes it a really, really hard path for any Republican. I think that the calculus as to why Stefanik, I mean, I think one woman, do you run a man against a woman or do you run a woman against a woman? Two, name recognition. Certainly has the most name recognition out of any elected Republican woman in the state that I can think of. Is it winnable or not? I think it's anybody's guess. A million things could happen in a year. You look back a year and look at the numbers from that election cycle, and you look forward a year and the numbers from this election cycle. You know, there's a lot that can happen. That's pretty much the sum and substance of my thoughts on it. Not surprised that it's all about Trump versus Mamdani, because, you know, nationally, I think the congressional Republicans who are very concerned about losing their majority, rightfully so, historically in a midterm, the party in power loses the majority. They think that this is a benefit to them. So I think it all remains to be seen, and what happens nationally in the city is going probably to determine how people feel in a year.
And remember, Lee Zeldin came very close.
He did,
when he ran. Now, so he's now destroying the EPA. That was his his consolation prize. But it's, I just think the political climate is so different this year and next.
When he ran in 2022 against Kathy Hochul, he received 46.7% of the votes. She received 53.1%. Yeah. Of seven. The vote. But and I know this is a fool's errand to do this, and I mean show pictures on the radio, but the map of New York and just a scattering of, I believe, eight counties that went Democratic, but obviously the population centers and where the most people are. But as far as a growth opportunity for a Republican, or for a Democrat, for that matter, there are a lot of areas. And also, interestingly enough, follows the Thruway.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah,
interesting. You show that because I did the math on that last night.
Of course, you did.
It's a shame that trees don't vote. 60%
This
of
is the Lorax, professor.
A little over 60% of the population lives in New York City, Albany, and the Buffalo, Syracuse, Rochester metro area. Those aligned with the map. Joe showed. So, yeah, when you look at a map of New York State, it's almost all red, except for these dark blue pockets.
The national version of that, it's the same thing.
It is the same thing.
But again, farmland doesn't vote.
Absolutely the same thing.
No, I know. So, you know, luckily for Democrats, generally speaking, right?
That's why they're the Senate. So, right. Yeah, that's the check on that.
You know.
We have to go to a break, but I just want to throw this out as a question, which is it not possible? I would think that Elise Stefanik, who has had national exposure for the last 10 years, is a bigger name than Lee Zeldin, and Lee Zeldin got almost 47% of the vote.
Yeah, I think a lot of things could happen. I mean, she's got name recognition. Her seat is generally viewed as a safe seat for Republicans, so they don't risk losing that seat. Now, I mean, I don't believe safe seat math, generally speaking. I think gerrymandering is sometimes a fool's errand. But having been moved into three different districts in like 2 years, right. And by the way, New York actually redistricted midterm before any of these other states did. But I don't think anything is safe, and I don't think anything is decided at this point.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Friday, November 7th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.